From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this holiday edition of Fresh Air, country music Hall of Famer Dolly Parton. She made her debut at the Grand Ole Opry over 40 years ago when she was just a kid, and has written thousands of songs, including the Whitney Houston hit, I Will Always Love You. On her latest CD, she returns to the traditional mountain music she grew up with. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the first of the big-budget summer movies, Pearl Harbor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congressman Joe Moakley died today at Bethesda Naval Medical Center near Washington. A 74-year-old Democrat from Massachusetts had been fighting leukemia. Congressman James McGovern, a colleague and former aide, said Moakley always served his constituents.
Joe Moakley did some incredible things in his life, but he was also a man who never forgot where he came from. From the streets of South Boston to the jungles of El Salvador, Joe stood for and fought for justice. No matter who you were, if you needed help, you had a friend in Joe Moakley.
Moakley was first elected to Congress in 1972, and he served 15 terms. The United States and China have reached a tentative deal on how to get a downed American surveillance plane home from a Chinese airfield. The EP-3 made an emergency landing in early April after a mid-air collision with a Chinese fighter jet. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
U.S. and Chinese officials have agreed in principle to use an Antonov 124 to fly the American surveillance plane home. Details, including timing, still need to be worked out by defense officials. The 124 is a massive Soviet-built cargo plane, similar in size to the Pentagon's C-5. It's big enough to allow the American spycraft to be disassembled into just a few pieces rather than breaking it down and crating it out, an option U.S. officials didn't like. The administration was pushing to repair the spy plane while still in China enough to fly it home, but using this huge cargo plane is an acceptable choice. An administration official says the agreement will get the plane home faster, but he added it's too early to tell whether the EP-3 will fly surveillance missions again. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The Treasury Department is preparing to start sending out income tax rebate checks of up to $600 as part of the tax cut legislation enacted by Congress over the weekend. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
Nearly 100 million Americans will be eligible for the rebates. Single taxpayers will get up to $300, single parents up to $500, and married couples as much as $600, depending on their tax liability. The rebates reflect the first year of a new lower 10% income tax rate on the first $6,000 of individual income or $12,000 for joint filers. The refunds were not part of President Bush's original tax cut proposal, nor of the separate bills passed by the House and Senate. But as congressional conferees began working on a final compromise measure, the administration pushed for the tax cut refunds as a way to boost the struggling U.S. economy quickly. The Treasury Department says most of the checks will be mailed in August and September. Some people, though, may not get their checks until later in the fall. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The president of the Philippines is threatening to crush an Islamic rebel group that's kidnapped 20 people, including three Americans. The Abu Sayyaf rebels said they seized the Americans and 17 Filipinos. This is NPR. President Bush spent most of the day in tributes to America's war dead. He just concluded a speech at the Champlin Fighter Aircraft Museum in Mesa, Arizona. Earlier today, he placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns in Arlington National Cemetery, and he signed legislation that clears the way for the building of a World War II monument on the National Mall. The president now heads to California for his first visit since losing the state to Al Gore in the presidential election. The state of New Jersey is paying a hefty price for its decision to settle racial profiling lawsuits. The largest portion of the money comes from one highly publicized case. Gene Dillard reports.
The New Jersey Attorney General's office says more than $25 million in settlement funds were paid out this year, compared to less than $15 million last year. The increase results from a decision to drop 77 criminal cases against drivers who were found with drugs, allegedly as a result of racial profiling by police. William Buckman, an attorney who represents some of the minority motorists suing the state, says the payments could have been avoided.
If so many of our officials had acted responsibly 5 years ago, a decade ago, we wouldn't be paying out these types of settlements.
The lion's share of the increased money this year, $13 million, went to four minority men who were shot by two white troopers in a controversial 1998 turnpike traffic stop. For NPR News, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
Secretary of State Colin Powell is in Budapest, Hungary today to assure NATO allies that the United States means to keep its troop commitments in the Balkans. Powell said he'll try to convince the NATO foreign ministers that the Bush administration will keep its troops in Bosnia and Kosovo as long as its allies do. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dolly Parton is one of the few performers who's been successful enough to start her own theme park, but her recording career has recently taken a turn away from the more commercial end of country music to roots music. This year, she won a Grammy for Best Bluegrass Recording for her CD, The Grass is Blue. It features songs by Lester Flatt, the Louvin Brothers, Johnny Cash, and Hazel Dickens, as well as Parton originals. She released a new CD earlier this year called Little Sparrow, featuring traditional mountain music she grew up with, as well as original songs in that vein. Dolly Parton was born in 1946 in a one-room cabin in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee. She made her debut at the Grand Ole Opry in 1959. She's written over 3,000 songs, including the Whitney Houston hit I Will Always Love You. I spoke to Parton earlier this year. Let's start with the title track of her latest CD, Little Sparrow.
Little sparrow, little sparrow, precious, fragile little thing. Little sparrow, little sparrow, fly so high and feels no pain. Never trust the hearts of men. They will crush you like a sparrow, leaving you to never mend. They will vow to always love you, swear no love but yours will do. Then they'll leave you for another, break your just fragile your little thing. Little sparrow, little sparrow, fly so high and feels no pain.
That's Dolly Parton with the title track from her new CD, Little Sparrow. Dolly Parton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Ain't you glad we started out with something upbeat, like a broken heart? No, but anyway, I thought that would be a good one to start with, since it is the name of the album that I'm out trying to promote, because I need the money, because you know it costs a lot to make me look as cheap. Ha ha. But anyway, thanks for having me on, too. I'm looking forward to spending some time with you.
This new CD and your previous CD, The Grass is Blue, they're both traditional music. And I'm interested in why you're heading in that direction now, you know, as opposed to a more... almost like show business version of country music.
Well, I have always loved this kind of music. I really think this style of music is more suited to my voice. This is the kind of music that I used to sing all my days growing up back in the Smoky Mountains. And this music is really so now people are really into the simplicity of it. And so just for fun for myself, there was a poll in the bluegrass community of what person they'd like to hear most do a bluegrass album that hadn't done one, and they said me. So I won, you know, hands down with that. So I said to Steve Buckingham when we did The Grass is Blue, the album just before this one, I said, well, let's just do a bluegrass album. And lo and behold, we won the bluegrass album of the year with that. So we thought, well, we need to do something along the same lines, but I didn't want to just do a full-blown bluegrass album and try to just do exactly what we did with the other. So we wanted to expand it, so we did a little more mountain music. We added a little bit of flavors of some Irish sounds also. So I call this blue mountain music. It's like bluegrass and mountain music, so that kind of seems to sum up what the style is, I think.
Now, you were born in 1946 in a one-room cabin in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee. What was the music you heard as a child?
Well, a lot of the stuff that we heard was that old porch picking music, old songs brought back from England and Ireland, that old Appalachian music, and a lot of the stuff that people up in the mountains wrote. So my mother was, and all my mama's people used to always play and sing. Mama used to sing a lot. So we would sing like a lot of the old gospel songs. A lot of old gospel songs were written to sound old, like I say, by a lot of my own people.
Who was most musical in your family?
All of us. My mother was very musical, and my grandpa Jake, I think, was a preacher, Pentecostal preacher, that I wrote a song about many years ago called Daddy Was an Old-Time Preacher Man. I think he was a music teacher of sorts back there in the hills. I think we really got our talent from, you know, from Mama's side of the family, although some of my dad's people pick and sing as well. But there's 12 of us kids, as you mentioned, 6 girls and 6 boys, and we all sing and write and play. It's just that I think I've taken it farther. I don't know that I'm near as good as some of the others, but I've been more willing to sacrifice and work a little harder than some of the others might have been willing to, you know, to do, just because they wanted to have a family and do other things. But there's a lot of talent in this family.
Do you remember the first songs that really meant something to you?
Yeah, the songs that I used to hear my folks sing back home and stuff. Mama used to sing about, she used to tell stories from the Bible and sing a lot of those old-timey songs. But the stuff I used to hear was at church. One of my favorite songs of all time is If We Never Meet Again, This Side of Heaven. And my dad passed away a few weeks ago, and he always loved that song. And of course, I was way too emotional.
I'm very sorry.
Thank you very much. But I was too emotional to sing at Daddy's funeral, so like later I went up to the grave and just sung it for myself and for Daddy. So anyway, those are the kind of songs that I always loved. And I recorded If We Never Meet Again on an album once from Dollywood, a live album. That album was called Heart Songs, and they are heart songs. So I grew up just loving all those old folk songs of tragedy, you know, like the Two Little Orphans and all that sort of stuff. And someday I hope, and possibly even for my next album, to do an album of a lot of those old mountain true folk songs.
When did you start writing songs and realizing that you had an ear for that as well as for singing?
Well, I started singing already on television when I was 10 years old, but I started playing guitar and writing serious songs when I was about 7. And my mother was always fascinated with the fact that I could rhyme so much stuff. So she used to keep stuff that I didn't remember I had written, and she has stuff in a trunk. And many years ago, she said, here's some stuff you might want to look at. This is stuff you used to write before you could write, before you could write it down, and she used to write it down. So actually, I've been doing it all my life, seriously and professionally, since I was 10.
Do you remember any of the songs you wrote as a girl?
Oh, I used to write songs about Cobb dolls. I had this little Cobb doll, the first song I remember writing. Her name was Tasseltop. It was a little doll that Mama, Daddy had burned poker hole eyes in to make eyes. And Mama had put the corn silk hair back on her and made a little dress for her, and her name was Tasseltop. And I did, I think I was 5 or 6, you know, somewhere in there, 7. And it's like, little tiny Tasseltop, I love you an awful lot. Hope you never go away. I want you to stay, and so on and so on. So I just wrote all about her dress and all about her hair. So, yeah, I just wrote about everything that, you know, that come to mind.
Were you writing about tragic love and heartbreak by the time you were 10?
Yes, I was, as a matter of fact. I wrote a song, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it was about a boy getting killed in the war, because we used to hear all those stories back home. And if they weren't singing those sad-ass songs, they were telling stories about it. You know, it's like, and that makes an impression on a little child. So we thought I thought that you needed to write some really songs of tragedy. I thought you had to do that in order to be a mountain singer.
And I wonder how it sounded with you as a girl singing these tragic songs.
About the same as it does now. My voice ain't changed a lot. Sometimes people say my voice sounds like a little girl singing all these Lord awful songs. It's like this, like Little Sparrow and the Silver Dagger from the other one, and you know, Tender Lie from this one. It's like I love to sing all those sad songs.
Well, you know, rare is the singer who can sing as much as you have and not have it roughen their voice.
Well, my voice is of a high pitch, so I guess I don't, you know, think my voice will ever deepen or lower itself in any way. But it's, you know, it's one of those voices I hope that'll last a long time, because I hope to be singing even when I'm old. Hope to sit out on my own porch and sing those old folk songs and maybe put them down on tapes and sell them. But anyhow, I just love, and a lot of the songs I write, like, for instance, on My Blue Tears, a song that's on this album that I wrote many years ago, and we can play that if you want to after this, but I wrote this song, and it really uses a lot of the old English style, like fly ye away from my window, fly ye as far, it's like the yees and the yays. It sounds old-timey. So I had recorded this song numerous times, but some of my songs I like so well, I think, well, they just seem to fit here and fit there. So it kind of lended itself to that Irish feel. So it's one of my favorites. You want to play that one?
Absolutely. But before we do, tell us when you wrote it and where you were in your performing career at the time.
Well, I wrote it about 25, 30 years ago, I guess. And I was sitting on a couch in a place where I lived over in Antioch, Tennessee, in one of the first houses that I had after I'd moved to Nashville and had gotten married. And I just remember wanting to write something old-timey, because I was probably homesick or thinking about the old days. And I just started, you know, just singing it. And I was at that time already probably pretty big name with the Porter Wagoner show, and that's where I had started. So I was trying to write songs that would make good records. And when I first did this one, it was more up-tempo, but on this version of it, I slowed it down.
Well, let's hear My Blue Tears, written by Dolly Parton, as featured on her new CD, Little Sparrow.
Fly away from my window, little bluebird. Fly as far as you can away from here, and let not your song fall upon my ear. Go spread your blue wings, and I'll shed my blue tears for the one that I have loved. He has left me and gone, and I'm for to hear your sad song.
Music from Dolly Parton's new CD, Little Sparrow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dolly Parton. Her new CD, Little Sparrow, is a return to the traditional mountain music she grew up with. Dolly Parton, in your autobiography, you said that when you were young, you read everything you could get your hands on, the Bible, the Farmer's Almanac, fairy tales, the funeral home directory. Is that about all there was in the way of books?
No. Well, there were books at school, but there were so many of us kids, we didn't dare take school books home, because the kids would just chew them up or pee on them or tear the, you know, the pages out of them. So they'd always tell us not to bring books home, because Daddy'd have to pay for them. But I used to read everything I'd get my hands on at school, and fairy tales I loved. So I would, you know, anytime there was a break at school, I could get my hands on a book, you know, on the desk or something, I would read that. I still love books. I read everything. I read all the whatever the hit books are on the bestseller list. I try to read that. People give me gifts, because I'd rather read when I travel on the bus and when I fly. I'd rather read than to watch television when I'm home. So I just enjoy that.
There were 12 kids in your family. Looking at your mother and the life that she was leading and the other women in the family, what did you think the life of an adult woman was going to be for you?
Well, I knew it wasn't going to be that. I knew that I had to go. It wasn't that I wasn't proud of who I was and where I was from, but I had a dream. I just couldn't imagine myself. I was babysitting from the time. I have a sister and two brothers older, and there's eight children younger than me, so I had a house full of kids because Mom was sick a lot. She had one on her and one in her for as long as I remember. So those of us that, were home, we had to kind of to do the chores. So I had kids. I had a house full of kids, and I just knew that I wanted to do something with my music, and I knew that I was going to leave when I was 18 years old. And I graduated from high school on a Friday night, and I left for Nashville the next Saturday morning. I was ready to go. And then I met my husband the first day I got there. We've been married for 34 years, and been together 36 years. I met him 36 years ago. And unfortunately, we never were able to have children of our own, but that's okay too, because after I moved to Nashville, I brought five of my younger brothers and sisters to Nashville that lived with me. We sent them to school. Now they have kids, and those kids call me Aunt Granny and my husband Uncle Peepaw. So we're really like grandparents to them. So I've still been saddled with a bunch of kids with no kids of my own.
Now, you've said that your grandfather was a preacher, your mother was devout. What was church like when you were young?
Oh, well, we were one of those shouting, healing, holy roller churches, and it was high-powered, which was great. I really learned to sing in church, I think, really with the emotion. And we were a free, it was a free-spirited church. And if you'd wrote a song, a gospel song, of course, you could get up and sing it and play your guitar and whatever. So it was really, there was a lot of that hellfire, brimstone, and scaring you to death if you go out unprepared, which, that's true. But I used to think, well, there's got to be more to that. They had me so scared of God, I was afraid to talk to him. I was afraid he'd talk back. And I was afraid he'd punish me somehow, with stuff. And I really, through the years, found my own place with God. And it was when I did that my life has been so peaceful and so rewarding for me to have a better communication with God than what I had grown up thinking I had to be so scared of him that I couldn't even go to him and, afraid that I was going to be punished for every little thing I did.
Now, when you were young and singing in church, did you sing about God in church and then sing about sinning at home?
Well, I used to sin at church and sin at home, and I'd talk about it. I used to always sit in church looking out the windows at the boys, wondering if I could make an excuse to go out and, go to the bathroom because all the outdoor toilets. But anyhow, I was only going out to see the boys. But anyhow, I had a deep faith in God, but I also, was high-spirited and fun-loving. And I, of course, was led to believe that everything you did, was a sin. But I don't believe that now. I think it's a sin if you believe it to be, and if it hurts somebody else, it's a sin. But I'm very deep in my faith. In fact, there's not an album that I do that I don't do something that is spiritual. In fact, a song I used to sing in church years ago that we did up tempo, one of the songs we sang every time we went to church was a song called In the Sweet By and By.
That's on your new CD too.
Yes, it is. And that's what I was going to say. And I wanted to do one of those gospel songs on this album. So I slowed this down and it lended itself real nice to some more of that Irish feel. So at some point, if you want to play that one, I think that would be a good choice.
Well, why don't we play that now?
Okay, let's do.
There's a land that is fairer than day, and by faith we can see it afar. For the Father waits over the way to prepare us a dwelling. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. We shall sing on.
That's in the Sweet By and By from Dolly Parton's new CD, Little Sparrow. Now, when you were young, you sang on the radio, and then you sang on TV, and it was before your family even owned a TV. Did it make it any more or less momentous to be on TV, knowing that your family and probably a lot of the other people you knew as well didn't even own one to watch you on?
Well, I don't think a lot of that registered on me at that time. My purpose was to go sing. I was singing on radio. To me, it was the same as singing on the radio. I didn't even know really what all it meant about singing on television. I just knew it was another place to go sing. They had microphones, and it was a show. So I was going to do the show. And so I don't think I thought about whether or not that somebody couldn't watch me. But after I did start being like a regular and bought our TV, I wanted my folks to watch it. But I bought the TV, but it didn't last long in the house because nobody around our area had a television. So everybody would come down and sit in our floor and sit on our couch, watch Gunsmoke and Wagon Train and Woody Woodpecker and all the shows that were on. And Daddy couldn't get them out of the house to get ready to go to work. So he said, this damn television's out of here. So that didn't last long. So it didn't matter if I was on television or not. You know, it's like me and Woody Woodpecker had to go.
Dolly Parton will be back in the second half of the show. Here's a track from her 1999 CD, The Grass is Blue. This is the Lester Flatt song, I'm Gonna Sleep with One Eye Open. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Just found out today the little game you play. While I've been sleeping all my life away, you've been stepping, so they say, between midnight and day. So I'm going to sleep with one eye open from now on. From now on. All night long. You won't have a chance to treat your mind. So they say between midnight and day. So I'm gonna sleep with one eye open from now on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dolly Parton tells us about making her first record at age 10, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Pearl Harbor. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview with Dolly Parton I recorded earlier this year. Her latest CD, Little Sparrow, is a return to the mountain music she grew up with. It's a follow-up to her bluegrass album, The Grass is Blue. Your first record, it was a 45. One side was Puppy Love and the other side was Girl Left Alone. How old were you when this came out?
I was about 10 or 11, I think, when I cut that. And that came out on Gold Band Records several months a year or so after that. That was my very first record, and that was a very exciting thing for me. The first time I ever heard that played on the radio, it was on a local radio show back home. It never did do anything other than just that it was the first, but it did play locally, and I about killed myself. I was sitting on a cabinet, sitting up on the sink cabinet with my and my aunt was cooking in the kitchen, and the radio was on, and my song came on, and I jumped off of the thing and slid on the rug and fell and trying to get to where I could turn the radio up. So I almost killed myself trying to get to hear my first record, you know. But it was fun. I'll never forget the thrill of hearing myself the first time on the radio. I thought, well, I've made it now.
Could you sing?
Of course, I hadn't.
Could you sing a few bars of one of those songs, the A side or the B side?
Puppy Love, yeah. Puppy Love, Puppy Love. They all call it Puppy Love. I'm old enough now to kiss and hug, and I like it. It's Puppy Love. It's got one of those silly songs, you know. You pull my pigtails, you make me mad. Then you kiss me, make me glad. Sometimes you even make me sad. Still, you're the sweetest sweetheart I ever had. Oh, Puppy Love, Puppy Love. And I was trying to get all those little bebop 50s kind of sounds in there, too. But anyhow, needless to say, it didn't sell much, but it was a start.
Now, these were songs you co-wrote, I think, with your uncle?
Mm-hmm. My aunt, Dorothy Jo, co-wrote The Other Side, The Girl Left Alone. Oh, yeah, that's when you was talking earlier about singing those sad songs. I was 10 years old singing, I'm a girl left alone, there's no hope for me. I'm tossed to and fro like a ship on a sea. I made my mistakes and now I must pay. Now, how many mistakes could I make at 10 years old? Now I can see that there's no hope for me. But anyway, it's like at 10 years old. So I wrote, my Uncle Bill, who was also my manager at the time, that also produced that record, the A and the B side, we wrote Puppy Love together. So those were just, you know, like I say, you got to start somewhere. And then my first record after that, I wrote with another uncle of mine. I was 15 years old and got on a major label, which was Mercury. And I had a song called It May Not Kill Me, But It's Sure Gonna Hurt.
How did that go?
Oh, it's that's about it. It may not kill me, but it's sure gonna hurt. And then it goes into fast tempo, and it's just about like losing somebody. It's like you're gonna walk away, and I'm gonna stay, and you know, and I don't like it. It may not kill me, but it's sure gonna hurt.
So when you were 18 and you took a bus to Nashville, left home, were you hoping to be a performer, a songwriter, both?
Yeah, I was going to be all of that. I was going to be everything I could be, but definitely I was going to be a songwriter and a singer, and that was what I headed out to be, was to be a star. And I vowed that I wouldn't go home until I had something to show for it, and I didn't. But I was very, very homesick, and I actually got real lucky, but it was about a year before I really had enough to show for it to think I could go home. And then I got lucky, too. I had a top 10 record on a song called Dumb Blonde. Like, just because I'm blonde, don't think I'm dumb, because this dumb blonde ain't nobody's fool. That was my first top 10 record, and I guess that was in about 66. That was in about 65, I guess, somewhere in there. So I just knew that that's what I had to do, and that was my destiny. I know now how lucky I was, because I know a lot of people that got there about the same time I did, had twice the talent, still ain't made it. So I know how lucky I've been, and I'm grateful for it every day, because I love what I do.
Now, another thing you did early on is that you sent songs to Buddy Killen, the head of Tree Publishing, which is a big country music publisher. And did you get other people to record your songs?
Well, I wrote a song with my Uncle Bill Owens, the same uncle that I was talking about. We had the Song of the Year, the BMI Song of the Year in 1966. And Bill Phillips had a song called Put It Off Until Tomorrow, You've Hurt Me Enough Today. And a lot of people through the years have recorded that song. So, yes, so I had different songs recorded by different artists, that being the biggest at that time. And I did write for Tree for a while. Buddy Killen was very good to me. And then Fred Foster, who owned Monument Records, took me over, and I started to write for Combine Music and record for Monument Records. And that's where I had Dumb Blonde and Something Fishy. I had two or three top 10 records before I started with the Porter Wagoner Show in 1967.
Well, since you mentioned Porter Wagoner, let me play a recording that you made with him in 1968, and then we'll talk about that period of your life. And the song is Just Between You and Me. Who wrote the song? Did you write this?
No, I didn't write that. And come think of it, I don't know who wrote that off the top of my head. That's been a few years.
Okay, so this is Dolly Parton with Porter Wagoner, recorded in 1968.
So I feel so blue, sometimes I want to die. And so I've got a broken heart, so what?
They say that time will heal all wounds in mice and men. And I know that someday I'll forget and love again.
Just between you and me, I've got my doubts about it. Just between you and me, you're too much to forget.
That's Dolly Parton with Porter Wagoner. You performed on his popular TV show for a while and, you know, made several recordings with him. How did you start working with him?
Well, Porter had the number one syndicated country television show in the country at that time. He had a girl on there for many years named Norma Jean, who had become a very big country star in her own right. And she got married, was getting married and moving back to Oklahoma City and left the show. And that left a spot, so Porter was looking for a girl singer. And I'd had, people had been talking about me in town, you know, the new girl in town, and that I had Something Fishy, Dumb Blonde, and a couple of other songs. And so Porter had just got wind of that, and he'd just called me down to his office for an interview. And so I sat down with my guitar and started singing songs that I'd written. And he was very impressed, and I got the job, and that's how that happened. Then we started doing duets together, which we were very successful. I was with the show for 7 years.
What did you learn about performing doing a weekly TV show?
Well, you have to learn a lot of things, not just the weekly TV show, but we also went out on the road together, did stage shows. I learned a lot from Porter, watching professional people work like that, as far as how to talk to an audience and how to be comfortable in front of a camera. And I had done TV back home when I was a kid. I had grown up singing on radio and TV back in Knoxville, Tennessee. But you have to learn how to not do silly things because the camera's on you, not pick your nose and stuff like that, or not to scratch your head or nothing, no other parts of your body. So you have to kind of just learn how to be aware that you're on because people are aware of you. So it's amazing how you really, I'm just like a sponge. I just gather up everything. You don't really realize what all you are learning just by watching professional people work, because a lot of the artists and stars that would come on Porter's show all the time every week, you learn something from everybody.
Well, I thought we could hear your original version of I Will Always Love You, which was used again in the movie The Bodyguard and was a huge hit for Whitney Houston. Do you remember writing this song and what you were thinking of when you wrote it?
Oh, absolutely. I remember that one. That one was about when I was leaving Porter Wagoner, because I had been with him 7 years. I had told him, because, see, I had plans to have a solo career of my own. I hadn't planned to get caught up with another group. But Porter's show was very successful, and it was a thing to do. And when I had told him I would stay, I told him I would stay for 5 years because I wanted to go on. But I stayed 2 years longer, but I kept staying and staying, and I kept wanting to go because I felt like I really needed to go out on my own if I was ever really going to have a solo career. And Porter was dead against it. He wouldn't hear of it, and he had a fit. We fought a lot. There was a lot of problems going on, and no matter how I would try to talk to him, I could not make him understand. And I thought, well, why don't you just write a song about him? Just say you appreciate him and you appreciate everything he does and that you'll always love him for everything he's done and that you'll always love him, period. So I just, out of a broken heart of not being heard or anything, knowing I had to make major decisions that would ultimately change my life forever, and his, for that matter, I wrote that song one night out of great grief and depth and just trying to say the right things to say goodbye.
Well, why don't we hear your version, your original version of I Will Always Love You?
Okay. If I should stay, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you each step of the way.
That's Dolly Parton, recorded in 1974. So do you know how the song ended up being used in The Bodyguard?
Well, they had told me that when Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston were doing this movie, Kevin also, I think, produced this movie and put all this stuff together. There was a song they had wanted to use, that they had planned to use as the theme song instead of I Will Always Love You. And then come find out, like a few weeks before, that they had, I don't know what the song was, but a few weeks before, the song they had planned to use, someone else recorded it and put it out. So they were in desperate need of a song to say basically what I Will Always Love You said. And from what I understand, Kevin Costner's secretary said, did you ever hear a song that Dolly Parton, that country star, you know, the one with the big boobs and the big hair? Seriously, she said, Dolly Parton, that country star, she said she had a song called I Will Always Love You, and I think it'd be perfect. And she brought it in to him, and they said he loved it, and so they chose it.
My guest is Dolly Parton. Her new CD is called Little Sparrow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dolly Parton. Her new CD, Little Sparrow, is a return to the traditional mountain music she grew up with. Now, you said that when you were young, you knew you wanted to be a big star. Why did you want to be a star?
Because I wanted to be rich. I wanted to travel. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to do stuff. I wanted to be seen, I guess. I need a lot of attention being brought up in a family of 12. You don't get much attention unless you're in trouble. You know, it's like, so I think it was just, I just had a very outgoing personality, and I wanted to be outgoing all the time.
When you got to Nashville and you started actually performing in the country music world, you started to meet people who had already been stardust. What did you see about their lives that you liked and that you didn't like? And when you started realizing that there were certain traps that one could fall into if one became famous?
Well, I don't think I even looked at it in that way. I just, being from a big family of all kinds of people, I know that people have problems. I just knew that I would always be myself. I would always stay anchored in the love of my family and in my faith in God. And if I stayed true to my music, if I stayed true to myself more than anything else, you know, that I would do that. I just always felt sorry for people that would get themselves in such messes. I've been in enough of my own, but I figured that was my own, you know, choice to get in it and to get out of it. So, but you learned real quick. But I think being brought up in a big family and all those brothers and my father and being very close to my uncles, I think I had a good understanding of men, so I knew how to maneuver and not allow myself to get caught in that trap. Just because I was a girl, you know, didn't mean anything. I was very serious-minded about my work, but knew how to enjoy men, knew how to, you know, maneuver in that world. So it was much easier, for me than it seemed to have been for a lot of the girls, especially, you know, that were new in town. So being a girl always served me well.
Now, you've joked that if you were a man, you would have been a drag queen.
I always say that it's a good thing I was a woman, because if I'd have been a man, I would have been a drag queen, just because I'm so damn gaudy, because I like all the flash and the glitter, and, you know, I just love, you know, I love playing in my clothes. I love playing, you know, in all in my life. It's like I love makeup, I love clothes, and I got the kind of personality that can pull it off, and I just love, you know, what I do. I'm comfortable being myself. Even if I make other people uncomfortable with the way I look, if I'm comfortable with it, then, it's okay with me.
How did you first start dressing in that, what's the word I'm looking for? Almost oversized, gaudy, oversized kind of way, where if your hair was big, it was going to be real big.
Well, I think a lot of that came, though, from a very serious place. That was a country girl's idea of what glamour was. And when I I didn't have any money to have stuff, and I've often joked about it, but it's the real truth that I patterned myself after what they considered the trash in our hometown. There was this one woman, I thought she was beautiful, and, you know, she had the peroxide hair, and she, you know, had it all piled up on her head and had red fingernails and red lipstick and you know, wore her powder, and I just thought she was the prettiest thing I'd ever seen. And Mama said, "Oh, quit looking at her. She ain't nothing but trash." And I thought, ooh, that's what I want to be when I grow up, trash. So that's where kind of my look came from, and then how the glamour girls and the movie stars and all that, you know, was really like that. But it was still, you know, I mean, I enjoy it. I still like doing it, and I've always just, it's like when they say less is more, that's not my motto. Mine is more, and the more I can get, the more I want of life and of everything. And it's like, but in addition to me being all that gaudy and all, I take my music and my writing very, very serious. And hopefully people know that my heart is true. And I've always believed that a part of my magic, if there was any, was the fact that I look so artificial, but I am so totally real. And I think when you hear these kinds of songs, I think you know that has to come from the heart.
We're talking about this really oversized image that you've created, but your new CD and the CD before that are really kind of scaled down. You know, they're traditional songs and bluegrass songs, sung you know, with a really good band behind you, but they're very un-show busy. Do you almost feel like you need to change how you look on stage when you're singing these kinds of songs with the kind of band that you have?
No, I don't think so, because I think people have come to know me as I am, and some people will never accept the fact that I'm a serious writer and a serious singer, and the ones that do accept it, they know it for a fact, and they overlook the image, which I've enjoyed playing in the image. So the only change I would make, only just from a show business fashion statement, I may wear some things that may be cut a little bit more country western, you know, like but it'll still be beaded, it'll still have shine and glitter on it. So it's not that I don't think I have to wear overalls in order to sing about a farmer. I don't think I have to. I think people would really be more disappointed if I dressed down, because they're so used to seeing me be the way that I am. I think that would bother them more. They'd think, well, I wish you'd have worn one of them rhinestone dresses instead of that old corny looking thing. So if I dressed down as plain and as real as some of this music is, I would definitely look like a farmer's daughter.
Dolly Parton, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Dolly Parton's new CD is called Little Sparrow. Here's the most surprising song on it.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some people go for cocaine.
I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, that would bore me terrifically too. Still, I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you standing there before me. I get a kick, though it's clear to see you obviously don't adore me. Oh, I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Still, I get a kick out of you. Yes, I get a kick out of you.
Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Pearl Harbor. This is Fresh Air. The new film Pearl Harbor kicks off the summer movie season. It's filled with action, romance, young stars, and lots of special effects. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
It's easy just to laugh at Pearl Harbor, a $135 million white elephant of a movie. At 3 hours, it's a veritable parade of absurdity, a travesty of a World War II romantic adventure enacted by an historically awful cast. Watching and listening, it's easy to imagine that screenwriter Randall Wallace awoke from a deep sleep and scribbled down dreamy memories of movies from the 1940s, shards of dialogue and bits of action that taken together make no sense at all. Director Michael Bay, who got his start making beer commercials, then translated these phantom cliches into hokey, overinflated images that don't depict emotion so much as try and sell it. But the Jerry Bruckheimer-produced Pearl Harbor is actually worse than that, for its ballyhooed recreation of the attack inadvertently exposes the movie's soullessness. The attack is the centerpiece of a movie which is just as calculated to earn Oscars as it is to sell tickets. But unlike the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan, this depiction of combat doesn't want to be too much of a downer. Although director Bay, at the end of the 35-minute sequence, does eventually get around to showing groups of sailors clinging vainly to listing decks, he spends most of his time showing stuff blow up good. He punctuates the attack with two visual flourishes. The first is simply a case of machine worship. Using computer technology, he's able to follow a bomb in a single shot as it's released from a Japanese plane, falls through the air, penetrates the deck of the USS Arizona, and lodges in its arms magazine and explodes. Bay then cuts to a shot of the huge battleship blowing up, a tremendous spectacle. Bay finally ends the sequence with rescuers vainly trying to cut open an overturned ship and rescue sailors trapped inside its flooded compartments. But they fail, and all we see of the trapped men are a pair of hands flailing hopelessly through the incomplete escape route. The lovingly detailed attack turns out to be more thrilling and exciting and real than the deaths of so many thousands, which is largely represented in the mere abstract. Not that the movie succeeds when it does try to hang some flesh and blood on these silhouettes. The egregiously terrible Ben Affleck and the merely talentless Josh Hartnett play a couple of boyhood friends from the South who sign up with the Army Air Corps in the late 1930s. After they've spent 2 whole years in the service, a period which includes extensive flight training, they are finally given a physical exam during which they meet a pretty nurse played by Kate Beckinsale, an English actress who has been pleasantly effective in light comedies, but who is miserably cloying here. Affleck's character Rafe falls for Beckinsale's Evelyn right away. But the skies and war beckon, and Rafe signs up with a mythical American division of the RAF, one of the movie's many historical boo-boos. Here he tells his old buddy Danny just why he's going.
Well, Doolittle assigned me. He wanted me to get some real combat training in. Well, guess what? It's not training over there, it's war. Where the losers die and there aren't any winners, just guys who turn into broken down wrecks like my father.
Yeah, I understand that, Danny, but I feel like I got a duty to go.
Don't preach to me about duty, damn it. I wear the same uniform you do. Now, if trouble wants me, I'm ready for it. But why go looking for it?
God, Danny, come on. I'm gonna be 25. I might as well be an old man. They're gonna have me being a flight instructor. I don't want to teach loops and barrel rolls. I want to be a combat fighter.
If you were to construct an anthology of bad writing and acting, right down to ludicrous accents, you couldn't do better than this snippet. As witnessed by the flyboy's strangely scheduled medical exam, the filmmakers can't even be bothered to keep logical track of time and place. Almost until everyone gets to Hawaii, you never know quite where anyone is or why they're there. The most awe-inspiringly stupid example of this tendency comes when Rafe boards a train in New York City that's apparently bound for England. At least that's where we see him next. If you cheat on the little stuff, the big stuff will also lack credibility. So, of course, the cataclysmic attack, where in reality thousands died and tens of thousands were wounded, doesn't really amount to anything more troubling than a video game sequence. How could the filmmakers possibly deal with a tragedy so massive? Only by cutting it down to the size of empty spectacle.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after tomorrow when the world is free. The shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait and see.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of Ann Tyler's novel Back When We Were Grown-Ups. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Journey to Secret Mongolia, a travel memoir by George Crane, in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the editor-in-chief of the Colombian newspaper El Tiempo about why journalists are under attack by drug lords as well as left and right-wing paramilitary groups. Also, we talk with actress Christina Ricci. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.